If Reese, you've never trained for SDV ops, Vic countered, having anticipated the request. All I do is get in the back and breathe whatever concoction they breathe. It's not like I'd be driving the thing. First off, they don't drive it, they pilot it. The answer is no. Well, at least put me on the redacted op. No. They don't know this guy. Neither do you. I know him better than you think, Reese snapped. Vic interlaced his hands and brought his index fingers to his lips. There's something else, Reese said.
I'm not gonna like this, am I? Vic asked.
Rafe is headed for Medney Island. He signed up for a hunt on the dark web. They left a URL with a login and password in Hannah's kitchen in Romania. He's going to get her.
Shit! You didn't try to talk him out of it.
I can see you don't know Rafe very well.
Did you get the URL and password?
Sure did, Reese said, passing the CIA executive a piece of paper from his pocket.
Shit, Vic said again. Just what we need. A former SEAL in the hands of Russian intelligence.
I can help, Vic. Get me on this up.
Again. No.
What if I go full-time?
Vic had been trying to convince Reese to come work as a ground branch officer in the Special Activities Division of the CIA since they first met.
You put me on this mission, and I come in for at least 4 years.
Vic tapped his index fingers together in front of his face, contemplating the offer.
You're on.
You knew I was going to offer that up, didn't you? Reese asked.
Let's just say I was prepared for your offer. The assaulters are already down at Redacted, training on a mock-up of the lodge on Medney Island.
You move fast.
We're the CIA,
Vic said, rising to shake hands with his newest recruit.
Nicole Fan and Andy Danreb are already down there. Remember them?
I remember, Reese said, thinking back to Andy's role in exposing the assassination and chemical weapon threat to Odessa the previous year.
As gruff and cynical as he is, with the Russia connection, Andy is our foremost expert. Nicole will be the connection back to Langley and the Counterterrorism Center. She plays much better with others than your friend Andy.
Vic looked at his watch.
If you leave now, you can make it in time for tonight's brief and FTX.
Reese wondered if Vic knew about Oliver Gray's connection to his father's death, or his obsession with taking out the sniper who had killed Freddy. He knew Vic would think those emotions would cloud his judgment, and he didn't want to discuss anything that would threaten his involvement in the mission. If Vic didn't know that the real reason Reese was coming on board was to settle a personal score, Reese certainly wasn't going to tell him. Reese left the executive level and made his way back to the lobby. This time, he didn't stop at the Wall of Honor, though he did pause ever so slightly as he walked across the eagle and compass rows of the agency seal. Visions of Freddie Strain and Thomas Reese had been replaced with the file photos of Nizar and Gray. The Syrian and the traitor were clearly focused in his crosshairs.
Chapter 57. Location Redacted. It took just over Redacted to drive the agency Suburban down to the CIA training facility. Situated on a peninsula, Redacted is a secluded Redacted training site that had gained notoriety as the rehearsal site for the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. A full mock-up of the compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, had been built so the assault force could memorize the layout of the world's most wanted terrorist's home. The SEALs tasked with completing the mission had been successfully assaulting compounds of every shape and size, year after year, on virtually a nightly basis since 9/11. But the Abbottabad mission would have worldwide geopolitical repercussions, so nothing was spared to stack the deck in their favor. The special operations community is a small one, and though he was older than many of them, Reese recognized a few of the Army commandos from various training schools and deployments. Navy Seabees were hard at work building a mock-up of the lodge on Medney Island for full mission profile rehearsals. Nothing was known about the inside layout, as all they had to go on was satellite imagery, which would ensure the outside was almost an exact replica of the target. 40 assaulters from Redacted had arrived a day earlier and had been preparing for what they had been told was a hostage rescue mission. They had assumed it was for a target in Somalia or Syria and had not yet been told mission specifics. That was about to change. When Reese drove in, most of the assaulters were in the chow hall waiting for an upcoming intelligence briefing. The unit, as it is known by the skilled operators in its ranks, drew heavily from the Army's 75th Ranger Regiment. An entire Ranger element had been killed alongside Reese's troop in Afghanistan 2 years earlier. As Reese sat down with his tray of food, a handful of Redacted assaulters, including their troop sergeant major, approached.
"Mr. Reese,"
the large bearded man began in an accent that betrayed a southern upbringing.
"I'm Christian Holloway, Troop Sergeant Major. I just wanted to thank you. We all knew the boys killed with your troop in Afghanistan, the Rangers on those birds. You did right by them."
One by one, the Redacted operators shook Reese's hand.
"Also heard about what you did in Odessa. Sorry to hear about Freddie. I worked with him in 09 in Iraq. Solid as they come. See you in the briefing,"
Holloway said with a respectful nod. Reese stood at the back of the stadium-style briefing room and wondered if this was the same room where his friends had first received word that the UBL mission was a go. The assaulters and a few support personnel filled the first four rows of seats, talking and joking among themselves. It was not that long ago that Reese had been in a similar room, receiving the mission that would lead to the deaths of his SEAL troop, Army Rangers, and air crews on a dark Afghan mountain. The door at the front of the briefing room opened, and Reese immediately recognized the looming figure of Andy Danreb. The Chicago native missed nothing and nodded to Reese without breaking stride. His customary blue Oxford shirt was rolled up at the sleeves. He was ready to work. Nicole Fan was almost the polar opposite of the older, disgruntled Cold War relic. She was young, spry, and always chipper. Reese couldn't remember ever seeing her without a smile. Anyone who mistook her kindness for weakness, though, would soon find themselves on the losing end of an intellectual battle of wits. Born in America to a family who escaped Vietnam in 1975, she was one of the CIA's most talented targeters. After the fall of Saigon, her grandfather had blended in with the boat people as a refugee to escape the wrath of the NVA. She was not the first in her family with ties to U.S. intelligence. She caught Reese's eye and waved. Some might find it intimidating to stand up in a room surrounded by hardened special operators whose lives depend on the information presented. If Nicole felt that way, her demeanor did not betray it.
"Good evening, everyone," she began. "I'm Nicole Fan. I'm an SSO targeting officer from the CTC. This is Andy Danreb from the Russian desk at the Directorate of Analysis, formerly DI for those of you who remember."
Andy nodded, his haircut and stern look giving the impression that he may once have worn the uniform, even if it was 30 years and 40 pounds ago. At the mention of Russia, more than a few operators began to send questioning looks toward the front of the room.
"This operation will be recognized as a special access program, so thank you for signing the NDAs earlier," Nicole continued. "I know you all have a lot of practice."
She hit a button on the remote in her hand, and a picture of a young woman filled the center screen.
"This is Hannah Hastings, American citizen. She was kidnapped in Romania by what is suspected to be a rogue element of Russian intelligence. We believe she was moved overland through Moldova and into Ukraine, where her captors crossed into Russian-held territory. An unscheduled flight of an AN-26 transport departed Zavodska airfield in Crimea less than 24 hours later. The flight made two brief stops for fuel and terminated at Shoromi Naval Air Station, a remote base in Kamchatka, Russia."
A map detailing the flight appeared on the screen along with satellite imagery of the isolated but paved 3,000-meter runway.
"This is Alexander Zharkov," Nicole continued,
advancing the slide to a file photo of the alleged perpetrator.
He is the deputy director of Directorate S in Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. In layman's terms, he manages their illegals program, running agents without cover status, sometimes deep penetration programs, and other times simply sleeper agents. His father is this man, Ivan Zharkov.
A black and white photo of the mafia boss replaced that of his son. Andy nodded curtly and pointed to the screen.
Ivan Zharkov. He's the Pakhan, or head of the Tambov gang in the Bratva, also known as the Russian Mafia. When the Iron Curtain fell in 1991, it was chaos, but a select few saw opportunity, hence the rise of Russian organized crime. Ivan was more adept than most. He thought ahead and pushed one of his sons, Alexander, into the Foreign Intelligence Service. He wanted his own mole. We believe it was information from Alexander that allowed Ivan to crush his competition and consolidate power under the St. Petersburg Tambov gang. He used his son to orchestrate the arrest of rival gangs through Interpol. You may remember the arrests made headlines in Spain back in 2008. Dismantling a criminal network made Russia look strong in the eyes of the international community. They elevated Ivan Zharkov to the undisputed position of Vorvasakhon, a top authority for the Bratva, eliminating his rivals and making him the second richest man in Russia behind their president. Point being, Ivan is a long-term thinker and not someone to be trifled with. There are uncorroborated reports of a rift growing between Ivan and his son. Alexander was recalled from a posting in Belarus after he was tied to the murder of a prostitute. It was covered up, presumably through hush money from the elder, possibly by intimidation of the investigators by Bratva thugs. With newly acquired intelligence, Andy's eyes moved to Reese, I correlated the information we have on Alexander's postings with unsolved murders, and although the information is incomplete, the timing certainly suggests that Alexander Zharkov may be responsible for a series of murders around the globe. A series of crime scene photos moved across the screen, each one showing a young female. Why not just turn all this over to Interpol? An operator built like a tank asked through a thick southern drawl.
Interpol has a surprisingly strong presence in Russia, but all that would do is tip Alexander off. If, and I say if, this mission gets the green light, you are her only chance.
Thank you, Andy,
Nicole said.
Alexander Zharkov left Moscow 36 hours ago on an AN-26 and landed at Shiromi Air Station earlier today. An hour later, an MI-8 took off from Medny Island, just east of the Kamchatka Peninsula. Medny is the smaller of two islands known as the Commander Islands and was all but abandoned in 2001. It's small, only about 71 square miles, but over the past 2 years, we have seen increased signs of military activity there.
Satellite imagery was projected of the island.
There is a bunker-like structure in addition to a larger metal building that houses vehicles. This summer, an array of structures was erected on various points of the island. Our theory, based on its proximity to Alaska, is that it is some type of radar or early warning site, but we can't be sure. We believe that Ms. Hastings was taken to the island and that she's still there. For how long, we don't know. We also believe that Alexander Zharkov is on the island with her.
A three-dimensional terrain model image of the island showed up on the screens.
To the best of our knowledge, this is the target structure. The CBs are almost finished with a mock-up for rehearsals, but remember, we have no intel on the interior layout.
Any other locations they may have taken her? Asked a man with the physique of a triathlete.
Ivan Zharkov has a dacha on the Black Sea where he doesn't spend much time. He also has a compound in central Siberia,
she said, bringing up a map of Russia and zooming in on an area in the middle.
It's located at the epicenter of the Tunguska event, of all places. He frequents it in the spring and fall, but we do not have any reports of Alexander accompanying his father there in quite some time.
Enemy situation?
Asked a laid-back-looking operator chewing gum in the second row.
Alexander is an odd one, Andy chimed in.
He doesn't trust his own military or intelligence services, and instead has contracted security from the Wagner Group. Heads nodded in recognition. As a refresher, Andy continued, Wagner is a private military company. Think the Russian version of Blackwater.
Didn't they get tied to the killing of those journalists in the Central African Republic last year?
The same operator asked.
Yes, along with disappearances and suicides of more than a few in opposition to Putin's policies. They've been very active in Africa, specifically in CAR, Madagascar, Sudan, and Libya. They continue to grow in power and influence, propping up Russian-backed dictatorships in Venezuela, Syria, and elsewhere. We estimate that Alexander has 8 to 10 Wagner contractors on the island and possibly a personal bodyguard, but we can't be sure.
How well trained are they?
The Wagner rank and file are mostly filled with regular Russian army personnel who are trained up at a Wagner compound in the North Caucasus region of southern Russia. They do have a small special operations component for special activities who handle operations like targeting those journalists in Africa.
The inquisitive assaulter nodded like these were normal everyday occurrences in the life of being a commando. Which, in fact, they were.
The big question here is why?
Asked Sergeant Major Holloway, verbalizing what they were all thinking.
I'll take that one, interjected Reese from the back of the room, making his way to the front. Nicole and Andy stepped to the side to give him the floor.
I'm James Reese. I met most of you tonight. I'm a former SEAL currently working for Ground Branch, though I think we are supposed to call it something else these days. The comment elicited a chuckle from a room full of people accustomed to senior-ranking officers renaming programs as a way to fill evaluations, insinuating that a highly successful established entity was entirely their idea before moving up the ladder in the chain of command.
Some of you may know Rafe Hastings, the former frogman continued.
Heads nodded again.
Hannah is his sister.
She was abducted in retaliation for events last year in which Rafe and I were involved. Rafe has gone dark. Our last communication was from his sister's residence in Romania. I think he's on his way to Medni alone.
Shit, Holloway said, leaning forward in his chair. So what you are telling us is that we have 2 potential hostages in Russian territory.
And that's not all. Reese hesitated. Recent intel suggests that Alexander has moved on from his serial killing of prostitutes and is hunting humans on Medni Island. He's going to hunt Hannah, but her real purpose is bait. What he really wants is to hunt me and Rafe.
What? Holloway asked in disbelief. How reliable is this intel?
Reese thought of Dimitri in Thorne's cabin, the capsaicin flowing through his veins, cooking him from the inside out.
Very,
concluded Reese, not bothering to use the military terminology associated with source verification. Holloway shook his head.
This is a new one. Though it's not usually my place to ask, how will this be handled diplomatically?
Nicole stepped forward to take the question.
If approved, President Grimes would call the Russian president only if things went south. Insert and extract via MHX Blackhawks, she said,
referring to the stealth helicopters made famous by the raid in Abbottabad.
We have AKs and Russian ammo sourced in Russia to make the actions on the objective look like a rival gang hit. This needs to be non-attributable to U.S. forces. Fallout could be a house cleaning inside the Bratva. Off the record, I think the president will do little to downplay any rumors of U.S. involvement. He will be eager to show the world that he is not a puppet of Russia after all the accusations of Russian meddling in the last elections when he was the ticket VP.
Holloway stood up and looked at his watch before turning to address his men.
Warno in 30 minutes. Time is of the essence on this one. It's going to be a long night. The next time you sleep, we might be on our way to Russia.
Chapter 58. Washington, D.C. Reginald Pine relished his role as gatekeeper to the president. One could say that the President of the United States was the world's most powerful figure, but in Pine's mind, the man who controlled access
to the president held the real power. A soldier for most of his life, President Grimes was acutely susceptible to Pine's influence and manipulation, not having been raised in the literal and figurative swamp that was Washington, D.C. Roger Grimes had spent a career as an Army officer and was selected as vice president to provide ideological balance to a ticket that would have otherwise leaned too far left for many of the nation's crucial swing states. With a decorated hero of the War on Terror by his side, the previous president cruised to an Electoral College victory. After Grimes was sworn in as vice president, he found that he was soon relegated to the background, rarely meeting with the president or his senior staff. It became clear that he had been mere arm candy during the campaign, and that the close advisory role that had been promised to the American people had been a facade. Grimes handled it like a professional and took it upon himself to focus on veterans' issues, appointing a commission to assess the VA healthcare system and then overseeing the implementation of its recommendations. Pine, a longtime Washington insider and former lobbyist, helped guide then Vice President Grimes through the morass of the federal government as he tried, mostly in vain, to advance the causes of those who had served their nation in uniform. The VP learned to trust Pine's political judgment and took his advice as he would that of an executive officer in the Army. For his part, Pine played the loyal soldier, biding his time for an opportunity to gain even greater influence. He couldn't care less about the VA. Those soldiers were stupid enough to volunteer knowing the risks. They were lucky to get free medical care for life. So what if they had to stand in line for a few hours? Pine found that the techniques from a book he'd read at Harvard on how to manipulate women into bed worked equally as well outside the realm of sexual coercion. Its methods helped him to influence and control both male and female politicians on policy issues. Sometimes he couldn't believe how easy it was. He'd started his professional lobbying career during a time when the tobacco industry was under attack. He'd learned that the old ways of throwing money at politicians and then threatening to support their opponents in the next election if they didn't stay on board didn't work the way they had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The opposition had organized and adapted. One had to play the game differently. There was no law against stupidity. If these idiots wanted to smoke and make the tobacco industry even more profitable, who was the government to stop them? Volenti non fit injuria. To a willing person, no injury is done. Besides, the U.S. government needed those tax dollars. How else were they to pay for a cradle-to-grave welfare state? He'd successfully delayed a 2006 court order mandating that tobacco companies advertise the ill effects of smoking. The government was forcing private companies of a legally available product to spend their hard-earned profits to undermine their own business. He had tied them up for 10 years in appeal after appeal. That the product he defended killed more than 480,000 of his fellow citizens annually didn't bother Pine in the least. It was a free country. And imagine the healthcare costs if those 500,000 people a year lived. The country would have to care for them for even longer. One of his main takeaways from a philosophy class while in college in Boston were the words of French biologist Jean Rostand. Kill one man, and you are a murderer. Kill millions of men, and you are a conqueror. Kill them all, and you are a god. Pine thought about how lucky they were that the media was so focused on the so-called opioid epidemic. With multiple states' attorney generals and their plaintiff lawyers distracted by the mere 70,000 opioid deaths a year, tobacco could recover from the hits they'd taken in the 90s. That his company was killing Americans at the equivalent rate of a 9/11 attack every 3 days didn't faze Pine in the least. While Vice President Grimes was fighting for his country, Pine fought to keep tobacco addictive
and profitable. His success in dealing with unconstitutional decrees from the government caught the attention of the budding vaping industry, and Pine was offered lucrative stock incentives to draft the strategy to deal with emerging federal regulations from the Food and Drug Administration and backlash from do-gooder groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and the American Cancer Society. Big Tobacco acquired controlling stakes in the leading vape companies early on, infusing them with capital for growth. They recognized the small electronic devices with candy-flavored liquid smoke were a gateway to their tobacco products and an opportunity to co-opt the next generation of customers. Pine managed to hold off regulation and a government-mandated review of vaping's health impact as long as he could, among an avalanche of increasingly devastating evidence. He'd been involved in D.C. lobbying long enough to know when it was time to abandon ship. The writing was on the wall. The multi-billion dollar e-cigarette industry was about to be regulated into submission. Pine took his money and ran for an even more distasteful occupation, political operative. Although his salary peddling cigarettes and the windfall of exercising his e-cigarette stock options in the vaping industry put him into what was increasingly referred to as the 1%, Pine was still an outsider. The families that controlled the tobacco and vaping companies had the homes, the cars, the jets, the multiple ex-wives, and the art collections. They had their names plastered over everything from university chairs to the wings of world-renowned museums. In both instances, Pine once again felt left behind, a hired gun to be kept content with leftovers from the plates of royalty. Where would they be without him slogging through painful media training, reading depositions, being deposed, and sitting through state and federal congressional testimony? He'd thought the newer and hipper e-cigarette company would welcome him into the clubs and parties he'd yearned for since his youth. It turned out that the gates to the kingdom were guarded by the same old boys' network that had plagued him all his life. They just wanted him to work the same magic on vaping that he had on tobacco, and then go home. After discovering that money alone was not enough to open the coveted door, Pine had given notice and exercised his stock options. On the way out, he leaked an internal memo on the company's advertising practices and an independent medical study on what was intended to show the benefits of vaping as an alternative to combustible smoking. The marketing memo clearly outlined the promotion of candy flavorings via social media marketing campaigns targeting children. The medical study warned that because the vape liquid contained lipoid components and toxins, when heated, they caused an acute chemical inhalation injury to the lungs. Or, as a federal lawmaker whose daughter had died at a college party after vaping with friends stated, "It poisons and kills our kids from the inside out. This is murder." Pine had gotten out just in time, leaving those at the company to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic as it headed for the inevitable. His memo and medical study leaked to New York regulators and a producer at 60 Minutes, along with the New England Journal of Medicine study on vaping-induced lung injuries, ensured the opioid epidemic was quickly replaced by outrage leveled against the beleaguered vaping companies. Say what you would about opioids, at least they'd never concocted a branding strategy around addicting children to their products. They specifically aimed their deadly prescription drugs at adults. Reginald Pine had grown up one of the worst kind of impoverished, a working-class kid in a sea of wealth. Even as a child, he insisted on being called Reginald. When his classmates found out how particular he was, they tormented him by bestowing him with the nickname Reggie Boy, a name he detested. His father had been a firefighter until a devastating injury almost killed him. After the accident, the Pines continued to live in what had turned into an exclusive enclave of New York, although across the border in neighboring Connecticut. His mother combined her meager salary working at the front desk of the very prep school Reginald attended with her husband's disability checks to make ends meet. Her position at the school discounted the tuition enough to allow Reginald to enroll with the children of means. The Pines wanted the best for their only son. Reginald would watch his friends' mothers zip off to play tennis after dropping their kids at school, the fathers having left in chauffeured vehicles for the commute into Manhattan well before dawn. There they managed the hedge funds and banks of Wall Street, which provided the money that gave them the power to look down their noses at the likes of the Pines. Reginald's family didn't belong to the exclusive clubs reserved for the top echelon of society, nor did they summer in the Hamptons or on the Cape. None of this went unnoticed by young Reginald. Years later, his success would certainly surprise the kids from his old Greenwich prep school, half of whom were probably addicted to Xanax, and whose kids were almost certainly destroying their lungs with watermelon-flavored toxic smoke. They'd be asking him for favors soon enough. All he needed to do was bide his time. His patience had finally paid off when the previous sitting president was forced to resign over what became known as the Capstone scandal, the testing of an experimental PTSD drug on active-duty SEALs without their knowledge. Overnight, Roger Grimes was president, and Reginald Pine was his most trusted advisor. Thrust into the most overwhelming job in government, Grimes relied heavily on those around him. As chief of staff, Pine wielded a tremendous amount of power. It was the opportunity he'd waited for his entire life. This morning, he was meeting with the CIA director and her senior staff for a highly classified briefing in the secure White House Situation Room. Ordinarily, such a meeting would be attended by members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Director of National Intelligence, as well as representatives of the various agencies that made up the U.S. intelligence community. That was the old way, as the staff called it. Pine's way was different. Under the new regime, the only people in the room would be Pine, the CIA director, Janice Motley, and Victor Rodriguez, her head of paramilitary operations. Even with all of the security clearances involved, the White House and cabinet leaked like sieves. The chief of staff could not risk word getting to the president over, under, or around him. If you wanted the president, you had to go through Reginald Pine. All the clubs he wasn't invited to growing up now held the door open for him. He'd finally found the elusive power he sought. He was somebody. The CIA executives were ushered into the secure White House Situation Room, a low-ceilinged conference room dominated by a large table that ran its length. Identical black leather chairs surrounded the table, and Motley and Rodriguez chose two near the head while they waited for the chief of staff to enter. The number of empty seats made the room seem bigger than it was, the inner sanctum of the world's last remaining superpower. Janice Motley was a deadly combination of intelligence and toughness. An African-American woman in her mid-50s, she was a relative newcomer to the agency, but had a long background as a staff attorney for the Senate Intelligence Committee. She had been appointed by the previous president to rein in what he saw as a cowboy culture among the clandestine service, but her initial decisions surprised her former colleagues. One of those was to approve bringing James Reese back into the fold as an asset, which was an enormous political risk given his status as a domestic terrorist. Subsequently, she'd approved the operation that resulted in Reese and Freddie Strain saving the life of the U.S. president by foiling a sniper and chemical weapons attack in Odessa, Ukraine. Those events had propelled her to the directorship. She hadn't forgotten that it was the bold actions of Reese and Freddie who had made that happen. Pine let them simmer for a good 20 minutes, the oldest power play in the book. He then entered in a flourish with his trademark blow-dried salt-and-pepper hair and capped-tooth smile. Despite a job that required long days indoors, his skin was tanned a deep copper. It didn't seem like the job was keeping him too far away from the golf course. He offered both a decent handshake and took a seat at the head of the table, in the chair embroidered with the presidential seal. The signal was an obvious one. In this room, I am the president. Pine glanced at his watch. He wore an Iron Man digital to work to appear folksy, a subtle but important manipulation. His Patek Philippe was at home. As was his custom, he started the briefing without small talk, indicating with a twirl of his index finger that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency was on the clock. Director Motley cleared her throat.
"Thank you for meeting with us, Mr. Pine. As you know, from the President's daily brief, an American citizen named Hannah Hastings was abducted in Romania. Evidence suggests that her captivity was at the direction of a senior Russian intelligence official named Alexander Zharkov, and that she has been transported to Medny Island, a remote island in the Bering Sea off the Kamchatka Peninsula."
Rodriguez was handling the visual elements of the presentation using a laptop to advance the PowerPoint slides on the large LCD screens that lined the walls.
"How confident are you that this individual is on the island?"
"Based on IMINT and HUMINT, our confidence is high," Motley replied, not giving up anything that would lead to further questions about the source of the HUMINT,
a source Vic had been reluctant to reveal.
"But no SIGINT corroboration?"
Vic winced in his seat, but Motley remained unfazed.
"Correct, sir."
"Go on."
"We believe that Alexander Zharkov, deputy director of Directorate S in Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, is also currently on the island. He is the son of a well-known member of Russian organized crime in St. Petersburg. I know that you are aware of the recent attack on a Montana ranch owned by the Hastings family. That was an attempt to kill one of our personnel and was carried out by members of Ivan Zharkov's crime syndicate."
"Who is that?"
Pine interrupted.
"James Reese, sir,"
the director answered.
"Great. That guy should be in prison. Only reason he's not on death row is because of that stunt in Odessa. Go on."
"After the hit in Montana failed, Director Zharkov kidnapped Hannah Hastings in Romania in an attempt to lure her brother and possibly James Reese to Russia to look for her."
"Why would he do that?"
"Here is a psychological profile on Zharkov,"
Director Motley said, pushing a file to Pine.
"Cliff Notes version, please. I have a country to run."
"He's a serial killer. He kills to fulfill an abnormal, sadistic, psychological gratification, thrill-seeking and sexual. In Zharkov's case, it was brought on by finding his mother after her suicide."
"This is giving me a headache. What's his end game?"
Rodriguez advanced the slide to a screenshot from the dark web.
"What the hell is this?" Pine asked.
"This,"
Motley continued,
"is from a site on the dark web. For $500,000 U.S., one can apply to hunt a person on Zharkov's island."
"What?"
"He imports prisoners from Africa. They become the prey. The website describes them as the worst type of criminals. Zharkov has taken care of the judge and jury parts. For $500,000, you get to be the executioner."
"And you are telling me he wants to bring in some bigger game?"
Pine asked.
"That is correct, sir. He was using Hannah Hastings as bait, and it worked. 2 days ago, Ms. Hastings' brother, a former Navy SEAL, contacted Alexander Zharkov via the dark web. His last communication indicated he was booking a human hunt in Kamchatka. Apparently, he does not trust us to get his sister out. He has not been heard from since. He had a TSSCI clearance, and there are a few things in his head we would prefer the Russians not access."
"Fucking SEALs," Pine said, rolling his eyes. "If they are not writing books, they're causing international incidents."
Director Motley ignored his sophomoric comment and continued.
In coordination with
redacted
and the joint staff, we've developed two courses of action for your consideration and would like to brief the president as soon as possible.
What are our options?
Mr. Rodriguez will walk you through plans, sir.
Thank you, Director. The acoustics of the room were unusual, and Vic felt like his voice sounded louder than the situation dictated. Mr. Pine, we briefed the joint staff this morning, and they have moved assets into place to facilitate multiple COAs if the president decides to move forward with a hostage rescue mission to return Ms. Hastings and her brother to the United States. As you know, we have successfully extracted,
redacted,
with SDV assets. The nuclear physicist last year, I remember approving the mission.
Vic bit his tongue, knowing the president approved the mission, not his chief of staff.
Yes, sir. This mission would use that same profile, but instead of a rendezvous and extraction, the SDV would carry assaulters from
redacted.
They would infill to the target and conduct actions on the objective using non-U.S. attributable weapons. What does that mean? They'd use AKMs with 7.62 by 39 sourced rounds from Russia to make it look like a mafia hit on the son of a rival.
And the second option?
CAG, aviators from the 160th, agency and FBI HRT operators have been rehearsing at a secure location. The plan is to stage out of Alaska, fueling low signature aircraft on the Aleutian Islands and inserting teams via HAHO. That's high altitude, high opening, onto Medni under the cover of darkness.
I'm familiar with HAHO,
Pine lied.
They'd use those same Russian guns?
Correct, sir. Continue. After insertion, the teams would move overland, breach the target building, and secure the hostages. The helos, the same kind used in the bin Laden mission, would then move in from an amphib in international waters and extract all U.S. personnel.
Pine leaned back in his chair and made a production of closing his eyes and heaving an audible sigh. He then leaned forward.
You want to invade Russia?
No, sir. Our plan is to briefly visit Russia to return an American citizen held against her will.
Interesting semantics. In both of these COAs, how long would your people be on the ground?
4 hours for the SDV option. One, possibly 2 hours for the airborne option.
Could this be some sort of sanctioned rendition of a former SEAL for something he did in service against Russia?
We do not believe that it is condoned by the Russian government. We also believe that if we go through official channels, Director Zharkov will be tipped off, which will cost Hannah Hastings her life.
Is that COA 3?
Pine asked.
Sir, if we go the diplomatic route, it is imperative that the president understand that he is signing the death warrant of a kidnapped U.S. citizen.
You don't know that,
Pine cautioned.
That is the official analysis of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
Director Motley held his condescending stare.
That was before my time, Mr. Pine,
she responded, without a hint of the fury she felt boiling inside.
Enemy order of battle,
Pine asked, bringing the briefing back on course and using a term he'd heard the president use on occasion. He'd made a note of it.
Alexander Zharkov doesn't rely on official Russian protection. He uses private security contractors from the Wagner Group. 10 are currently with him on the island. We do not believe that they expect a rescue attempt.
Don't bullshit me,
the chief of staff said, directing his question back to Director Motley.
What is Zharkov's beef with the Hastings family and this Reese character?
It is possible. It is retaliation for what they suspect was James Reese's involvement in thwarting the assassination of President Grimes last year in Odessa, and the subsequent assassination of Colonel Vasily Andrenov and the poisoning of General Kusim Yadid,
Director Motley said, quite intentionally bringing Reese's involvement in saving the president's life into the conversation.
Yes, most curious,
Pine said, leaning back in his chair. I've heard rumors that Mr. Reese is responsible for both of those assassinations. What do you know about that?
Rodriguez visibly bristled in his chair while Motley met the president's chief of staff's stare without flinching.
We confirmed that those were just rumors, sir. Both of those men had lists of enemies a mile long.
I see. And why would we risk an international incident, even war with Russia, to kidnap a girl and her brother who the Russians will say were there of their own free will?
If we don't, Director Motley answered, an American citizen kidnapped against her will is dead, and a TSSCI-cleared operator will be exploited for intelligence by the same country that manipulated the very technology we developed to influence our last election. This is a chance to hit back.
Pine tapped his finger on the closed cover of his iPad case.
How soon could you go?
All assets are standing by, sir, Rodriguez said. We could have the teams on C-17s within 45 minutes of the president's signature for either COA.
Pine continued tapping his iPad, thinking through options and worst-case scenarios.
I want you to thank the men and women who have been preparing for this possibility.
Pine paused for effect.
But there's no way in hell that we are invading a nuclear-armed Russia to get back one girl and her brother who are probably already dead. Do you have any idea what kind of international incident this would cause? Relations with Russia are already in the shitter. This could start another Cold War, or worse, World War III.
Sir,
Motley attempted to interject.
You had your chance to speak, young lady. Now it is mine. There will be no presidential finding. There will be no mission. Send your men back to Bragg or Coronado or wherever they came from. I want NDAs signed by everyone who is in the know on this. I don't need any of these assholes whining to their congressmen about it.
Sir, shouldn't the president weigh? Rodriguez interjected.
As far as you're concerned, I am the president. He will not be briefed on this, and any attempt to go around me and get to him will be career-ending for everyone involved. Do I make myself clear?
The two spies remained quiet, but nodded in recognition.
Good.
Pine's tone switched from enraged to almost effeminate on a dime. This room is secure. Leave your op plan for the executive files. Now, I'm sure the CIA has other threats to our national security on which to focus. Thank you for coming, and please enjoy the rest of your evening. He rose and strode out the door without shaking hands. He had just been passed a valuable piece of information. If he could relay it in time, it could pay dividends for him once the president was out of office. He needed to visit an old friend. Information truly was power. Chapter 59. Location redacted. Reese peered through the thermal optic on his SR-25E2, scanning the scene around the bunker structure for any sign of human activity. The light weapon thermal sight was mounted forward of his Night Force day optic and made any living thing in his scope stand out like coal on snow. Reese was at the closest of three Overwatch positions, just over 600 yards from the target building. The only movement he spotted was from the assault elements approaching the structure from two directions, operators moving swiftly and silently with the experience of hundreds of missions in hostile territory. They swarmed the building, masters in a deadly ballet. Reese shifted his weapon and, using the optic, scanned behind his position to ensure that no one had moved in behind them. All clear. His Overwatch function, devoid of the responsibilities and chaos of command, reminded him of the good old days as an enlisted SEAL sniper. He turned his attention back to the objective in time to see the assaulters set their breaching charges on the concrete building. Instinctively, he averted his eyes. A violent explosion rocked the building,
The lead elements stormed through the openings created by the carefully prepared shaped charges. The distance and the suppressors masked the sound of gunfire, but Rhys knew that the engagements were swift and violent. After 10 seconds that seemed like as many minutes, Rhys heard Sergeant Major Holloway over the radio.
"Objective clear. I pass. Touchdown, Dugga boy. Touchdown, Linus."
The operators were maintaining a perimeter around the target site, their precious cargo well protected at its center inside a phalanx of armor-clad operators. A quick glance at the screen of his chest-mounted ATAC device, essentially a smartphone with detailed mapping software configured for military use, confirmed the position of friendly forces and the location of the LZ. The lines between war and video games had officially blurred. Rhys and the rest of his sniper element were 200 yards out when they heard the odd-sounding whine of the stealth helicopters approach. He watched as the assaulters loaded the hostage into the first Black Hawk, which lifted off immediately, spiriting her to safety. He picked up the pace to a jog, turning every few seconds to check their six. He instinctively ducked as he passed through the rotor wash and climbed inside the helo alongside his sniper team and part of the assault element. His stomach sank as the pilot cranked the throttle and the powerful bird jolted skyward. Rhys's legs dangled out the open cargo door of the Black Hawk, his rifle ready to support the crew's 7.62mm miniguns if necessary. They were soon off the objective, skimming low over the terrain at high speed. Barring a mechanical failure or an interception threat from a Russian fighter jet, they were in the clear.
"All elements, this is Argo 6. Endex. I say again, Endex."
Rhys heard the command element's call over the Peltor headset that he wore under his ballistic helmet. That was the signal ending the exercise. From Rhys's perspective, it had gone exceptionally well. Now they just had to do it for real, against an armed enemy defending home soil. Even seasoned professional commandos felt the euphoria of a job well done, and the mood during the debriefing was light but serious. Every pilot, operator, and support soldier involved in the operation was in the room. Men in sweat-stained combat uniforms sipped coffee, Killcliff, Gatorade, or Red Bull, each fighting their body's circadian rhythm, which told them it was long past time to go to sleep. The clock on the wall indicated it was just after 0400, and despite having trained every night and slept during the day for the past 5 days, everyone was exhausted. The special operations culture is unique in its willingness to ignore rank when it comes to providing brutally honest assessments of an action. Though the mission went well, there was always room for improvement, and the men in the room made no bones about what could have gone better. Drone footage of the assault was played back on the oversized screens and paused at various intervals to allow for discussion. The movements of each individual operator could be tracked using the ATAC software and were displayed and scrutinized the way that game films were in a football locker room. The technology left no doubt as to who did what, when. Rhys's role was that of a ground branch liaison, there to support the highly capable operators who would perform the rescue. He had a reputation as a solid combat leader, and because his post-war exploits had given him near legendary status in this community, Sergeant Major Holloway asked if he had anything to add. "Just that if it was me on Medni, there is no other group of killers I'd want kicking in the door to do the job. Thank you all for—" Rhys's phone buzzed. "Excuse me," he said, seeing Vic's number come up in the caller ID. Walking a few steps from the Army commandos, he accepted the call. "Talk to me, Vic."
"It's a no-go, Rhys."
"Shit!"
"President's chief of staff shut us down."
"You didn't even talk to the president? Get me his number. You're the CIA. Get me his private line. I'll call him directly and cash in those chips from Odessa."
"I know you're pissed, Rhys. Director Motley and I have been talking all night about how best to handle this, but right now our hands are tied."
Rhys was about to continue, but instead switched gears. It was time to think, not fly off the handle. "Sorry, Vic."
"Understood.
I'll let the crew here know. Pass on the director's sincere thank you to everyone on site. Get some rest and take your time getting back. We will figure this out. Like you said, we're the CIA. Reese ended the call and turned to see the room of sweaty operators looking at him, already knowing what he was going to say. They'd been spun up only to be turned off more times over the years than they could recall. "Mission is kanked," Reese said. "Director Motley thanks you all for your efforts, but it's a no-go." A few heads hung in silent resignation before they started to shuffle to the door. Sergeant Major Holloway approached Reese.
"Sorry, friend."
"Yeah.
You guys got a bar around here?"
"How'd you guess? Follow me." Most of the seats and bar stools were already taken when Reese and Christian Holloway entered the makeshift bar.
"What a find," Reese remarked, looking around the cavernous interior.
"Well, we've been down here so much over the years, we figured we needed a place to call home. Your CB's built it for us. Built one for Blue, too."
Plaques adorned the walls, red party lights were strewn from the ceiling, and speakers linked to one of the operator's playlists filled the small structure with the songs of Johnny Cash.
"Join us for a beer?" Holloway asked.
"Give me a few minutes," Reese said. "I'm going to grab a whiskey and do a little thinking."
"Dangerous stuff, that thinking business," Holloway remarked with a smile.
"That's what they tell me," Reese replied, making his way behind the self-serve bar, nodding to the redacted operators, who raised their glasses as he passed.
After picking through a seemingly unending supply of whiskey bottles, Reese selected a Woodford Reserve on ice and settled into a bar stool at the far end of the bar, swirling his whiskey and ice with a plastic stirrer. The sun was coming up as the last operators left the bar. Reese's ice had long since melted and he still hadn't taken a sip, his thoughts lost on Hannah, Rafe, Ivan Zharkov, Alexander, Oliver Gray, and Medney Island. He didn't even look up when the looming figure of Andy Danreb took the seat next to him.
"How's the whiskey?" Andy asked. "Looks a little watery."
Reese picked his head up and looked around. "Are we the last ones here?"
"Brilliant observation. You should come to work for the CIA.
Guess I lost track of time.
Bars will do that.
That water?"
Reese asked, motioning to Andy's drink.
"Vodka. It's like water, only better. I am from the Russian desk."
"Makes sense.
What are you doing, Reese?"
"Just thinking."
"Ah," Andy said, taking a swig of his vodka. "In the Cold War days, we used to do a lot of that."
"What?"
"Figuring out how to get the job done when senior intelligence officials or politicians told us we couldn't."
"How did you handle it?"
"We outthought them," Andy said, tapping his temple with his finger. "We used to call it plausible deniability. Sexy term for giving your superiors the ability to say they had no idea what you were up to, and yes, sir, I'll rein those cowboys in right away, and this will never happen again, sir."
Andy chuckled.
"Your old man did it more than once."
"You knew my old man? Why didn't you tell me?"
"Everyone knew your old man, Reese. If not in person, then by reputation. And I didn't tell you because it wasn't pertinent the last time we met."
"And it is now?"
"It is,"
Andy said, taking another sip of his drink.
"How?"
"Once your dad was ordered to stand down and hang a certain doctor he was running in Czechoslovakia out to dry. Do you know what happened next?"
Reese nodded.
"Good. What do you need to pull it off?"
"Take a breath, look around, make a call," Reese muttered.
"What was that?"
Andy asked.
"I'm a bit hard of hearing these days."
"It's something an old troop commander of mine used to say. Take a breath, look around, make a call."
"Well, you've taken your breath, now look around."
Reese picked his head up, his eyes slowly taking in the plaques and mementos that adorned the walls, commemorating the exploits of one of the best special operations units the world had ever known. He smiled.
"Thanks, Andy," Reese said, moving off his stool, leaving his Woodford untouched on the bar.
Chapter 60. Rhys stepped into the early morning light, stopping briefly to shield his eyes from the sun as he fished out his gaiters, sunglasses, and slid them into place. Running toward one of the hangars used as a staging area for gear, he could see the, redacted, operators already inventorying gear and packing up for the journey back to Bragg. "Christian," Rhys called, seeing Sergeant Major Holloway checking on his troops.
"Hey, buddy. Hope you don't mind us sliding out on you this morning. You look like you didn't need anyone disturbing you."
"No worries. Listen, I just got a call from Vic at the agency. He's working some other options on this Russia mission. He wanted me to see if we could 1149 some equipment," Rhys said, mentioning the form that serves as a requisition and invoice document anytime something of value trades hands in the military.
"Really?"
Christian said.
"Yeah, just want to make sure it's all official. I'll sign the 1149s and take custody of the gear. Should get it back to you in a couple weeks."
"Rhys, has anyone ever told you that you are the worst liar on the planet?"
Rhys shrugged and raised his eyebrows.
"What exactly do you have in mind?"
"Just some parachutes, nods, radios, and 416s? Rhys asked. "Oh, and to go with the chutes, we'd need CPS thermal suits, heated Wilcox nav boards, oxygen kits, basically anything necessary for a high-altitude parachute insertion in Arctic conditions."
Sergeant Major Holloway folded his arms and dropped his head in thought.
"Well, I guess that's more reasonable than trying to 1149 one of the helos. How many?"
"Five should do."
Holloway rubbed a hand through his heavily stubbled face, as if calculating the possibilities.
"I think I can probably part with five kits like that in the name of interagency cooperation. Post 9/11, we are all supposed to share our information and our toys. As you know, we always travel with extra gear, especially when we are not sure of the mission ahead of time."
Rhys took a sigh of relief.
"Thank you."
"Don't mention it. I'll get Marcus to put together the 1149s for you to sign, and the boys will help load everything up."
"And, Christian, just curious, how long would we have before these would come up in the system?"
"They will come up at next inventory in," Holloway looked at the date on his G-Shock, 20 days, but even then, they will come up as 1149 to you, until we need them back, which we won't. Those are officially the property of the Central Intelligence Agency."
Location redacted. The airfield was jointly operated, half Coast Guard and half civilian, with, redacted, aircraft sitting opposite a collection of civil aviation aircraft, mostly single-engine, propeller-driven planes. Though, redacted, didn't ordinarily see much Gulfstream traffic, its, redacted, runway offered plenty of room for the business jet to land. It touched down gently, tufts of blue smoke swirling off the tires. The pilot steered the jet toward the black Chevy 2500 Suburban parked outside of one of the civilian hangars near the FBO on the south side of the airfield. James Rhys was leaning against the hood. The engines were still whining when the door folded downward and Liz Riley descended the steps.
"You're flying this thing now?" Rhys asked. "I'm just the co-pilot. I'm working on my pilot rating. It won't be long with you and Rafe jetting all over the world. Thanks for helping me with my hours."
"Liz, I have some gear to load. It's not much, but I'm guessing it should go in cargo. Do you have a laptop on board? I need to do some planning on the way back to Montana. Does this thing have Wi-Fi?"
Liz nodded.
"Of course it has Wi-Fi. It's a G550. What do you think we are, Spirit Airlines?"
The two friends wasted little time opening the rear of the SUV and loading the Pelican cases and kit bags into the Gulfstream. Liz assessed the approximate weight of the gear and made some notes on an iPad. 20 minutes after the G550 had touched down, the fuel had been topped off, the cockpit crew had filed their flight plan, and they were airborne again on their way to Kalispell.
Chapter 61. Petersburg Petroleum Company, St. Petersburg, Russia. Svetlana really did feel sorry for him. He'd morphed over the last month, gained confidence as he put his plan in place, only to have retreated into his shell
as that plan had deteriorated into abject failure. She couldn't help but wonder if the thumb drive she'd provided to the SVR had anything to do with it. Maybe she'd even take him home one night and help him find pleasure in a true sexual experience, instead of the manufactured embarrassments she'd employed to gain access to his computer. Who knows? She might even enjoy it herself.
I've made you some tea.
Thank you, Svetlana, he said, continuing to stare into his computer. Are you taking the metro home tonight?
Oh, Oliver, you work too hard. The metro only runs until midnight. It's already half past.
I am so sorry. I lost track of time. Let me get you a cab, Oliver offered, reaching for his desk phone.
You are too kind, but don't trouble yourself. The city is full of them, even at this hour. I can manage. Don't stay up too late.
She lingered for a moment, resting her hand on his shoulder and giving it a sensuous squeeze. She did not see movement in his pants. I won't, Oliver lied. Until tomorrow.
Until tomorrow,
she repeated. Good night, Svetlana. As soon as she was gone, Oliver picked up his cell phone and sent a text. He then reached for his pipe and stood, moving to the large glass window that dominated the wall of his office. Four men took their positions on the deserted street below. One walked past the building and took up station at the far end of the street. Another loitered at the opposite end of the block, while two others stepped into an alley. Oliver would have known they were Bratva thugs even if he hadn't just texted them to let them know their target was about to leave the building. In their dark jackets, jeans, and watch caps, they looked the part. Svetlana looked up and down the street for a cab and then began walking north to a corner where hailing one would be easier. She'd never make it. The two enforcers stepped out of the shadows into her path. Oliver's heart beat faster as he saw her stop and take a step back, then hold out her purse to them. She stole a glance up at his office window, and when she did, Oliver lit his pipe. As the fire from the wooden match illuminated his silhouette through the glass, the knives came out. They were upon her. Oliver could see three bodies mixed together in a violent clash for survival and caught the glint of a blade reflect off a streetlight. His breathing rate increased with the excitement of his voyeuristic encounter. He might not be able to lead men into battle, but he'd proven adroit at hiring low-level criminals to ambush the unsuspecting. He'd done it long ago in Buenos Aires. Observing the primal dance taking place on the gloomy street, he felt a now familiar rise against the fabric of his trousers. His hand found its way past his belt and into his pants. One stroke and his knees shuddered as he leaned into the wall for support, almost dropping his pipe as his body spasmed. Regaining his composure, he watched as a black Mercedes sedan pulled up to the curb. The lookouts had joined the knife men, and all four squeezed into the German import before it sped away. Oliver thought of the life slipping out of his matronly assistant, her blood running into the gutters of the old city. Straightening himself up, he set his pipe on his desk and went to the bathroom to clean up. Chapter 62. Glacier Park International Airport, Kalispell, Montana. Rhys gazed out the window as the jet rolled to a stop. There, waiting on the tarmac and leaning against a two-tone early 90s F-250, was Elias Malik. Jonathan had emailed Rhys in flight to let him know the team was assembled and would be waiting on him. Liz opened the door from the cockpit.
We have to do some post-flight and get ready for tomorrow. Eli's out there waiting to take you and the gear to the ranch. I'll be about an hour behind you.
Rhys descended the steps and approached his longtime friend.
What's up, Kahuna? The larger man asked.
People often assumed Eli was from Hawaii due to his dark skin, affinity for all activities water-related, and fondness for inserting words from the ancient Polynesian language into everyday speech. He had an aptitude for language and picked up a few words during his time attached to SDV-1 on Ford Island. Few knew his patriotism and devotion to country really stemmed from his family's escape from their native Lebanon in 1981 to his mother's home country of Sweden and eventually on to the United States. Eli's early years were spent just northeast of Beirut. He remembered the pine and cedar trees, eating pine nuts while watching the deer, squirrels, and rabbits, and even his introduction to skiing not far from his home. As Maronite Christians, those memories faded to recollections of his father and uncles picking up rifles and leaving to defend their enclave while the Lebanese Civil War destroyed what had been called the Switzerland of the East. With the dawn of the 1980s, the writing was on the wall. The old Lebanon was gone. It was time to leave. As they made their way to the airport, passing roadblocks in the uncertainty of a new decade, he remembered his mother telling him,
"Be strong, my lila krigare,"
my little warrior. Fluent in Arabic,